The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Happy New Year!
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Prince, Team Rock and Motown. It's the CMU Podcast, the week in music in... Oh, no. We've been away for a few weeks and I've forgotten how I start the podcast. I could restart, but I'm not going to. I'm Andy Bolt. With me is Chris Cook. Happy New Year. Hello, Chris. This is a new snappier podcast where we don't go back and correct mistakes and I talk very fast.
I like the suggestion that in 2016 you knew how to introduce the podcast.
I got very good at it.
And that your utter failure to do a proper intro to the podcast is an innovation for 2017.
I genuinely forgot halfway through the sentence what it is that we do. Say.
So if I was to say actually on this podcast we discuss recent developments in evolutionary science, could we then have a 50-minute conversation about that?
Given have a go.
Given that you've forgotten the format
if you want.
And the entire remit of what this podcast is. But I've not come prepared for that, unfortunately.
No.
I should have picked something
when has that ever stopped us?
I should have picked something that I could realistically talk about for 50 minutes.
Yeah. Anyway, you just mentioned there, it's 2017 now.
It is.
It's a new year.
It is.
It's a new world.
It is.
Everything has changed.
Nothing has changed.
Everything has changed.
It's an arbitrary number on a piece of paper that means absolutely
everything has changed.
Nothing.
No celebrity will die now. And politics
celebrities
is
have
fine.
Already died. Politics is
not
already
any
mad.
Celebrities that, I'm not going to finish that sentence.
Not any celebrities that matter,
politics
you were going to say.
Is fine.
Just because you're not interested in football.
Hey, I watched.
Who else has died so far this
I
year?
I watched a speech.
Did you?
By US President Barack Obama this week, and it was very inspiring, and I feel like that's, you know, that set the tone for the year. I mean, I did then immediately watch a speech by Donald Trump, but you can't have everything.
Well, which
can
was
you?
More entertaining?
I understood more of Obama's speech.
I've never really watched The Apprentice, US or UK, although I have seen clips. And when in the early days, when it was still being spun as, oh, this is all about entrepreneurial ideas and stuff like this, rather than it just being a circus as it is now. Having said that, I think it was always a bit of a circus. But anyway, my point is that I've always thought, and I wouldn't watch that show because it's just incredibly irritating. Because it's just full of irritating people saying irritating things and being irritating. And that's why I wouldn't want to watch that show.
Isn't that why anyone watches TV?
And in
what,
some
what
ways...
What other reasons are there for watching TV?
Donald Trump has based his entire presentation style on that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, he finished...
It's entertaining, but incredibly irritating.
He finished yesterday's press conference...
By saying you're fired.
As we're recording this, by saying you're fired. So, yeah, that wasn't even, you know, an exaggeration. He genuinely is sticking to his TV guns.
But also, once again, yesterday I was working, whereas you admitted that you didn't write the stories you intended to write yesterday because you got distracted by the presidential speeches, whereas I was working. Actually, I wasn't. I did no work at all yesterday. It was a really rubbish day. I finished my daily stories and then I had a nap and then I went out for lunch. But
I did a full day's work and then I watched some speeches and then I did some more work.
I intended to be really productive. But it's still that point in the year where other than the daily deadline, so I write my stories because the CMU Daily has to come out every morning. But all the other sort of deadlines I usually have, like I've got a new training course to deliver or I've got a meeting or I've got a report to write, I've got none of those deadlines at the moment. So therefore, we're journalists. We don't do anything unless there's a like completely and definitely unmovable deadline.
Oh, well, it's all right for you, isn't it?
But
There's never a point in my day when I don't have a deadline.
Next week, I have a lot of deadlines. So next week, I'll be back into super hardworking, efficient mode.
Oh, really?
My point about all this was, I didn't know Donald Trump was making a speech. I was aware of the stories that have been circulating in the previous 24 hours. Well, one story in particular. But I didn't know who was making a speech. But my Twitter feed just exploded. It was one of those things like, you know, how on a Saturday night when people start talking about stuff and you're like, what are these people talking about? Or they don't really do it with X Factor anymore, do they? But people in my social bubble, I suspect this will no longer be the case, but certainly as of 2016, they were still watching that Bake Off show.
Oh, yeah.
And so suddenly on whatever night of the week the Bake Off went out, suddenly there'd be all these tweets. I have no idea what they're talking about. And it would be, what was it, Great British Bake Off. So it'd be GBBO, the hashtag.
Oh, yeah.
And it would take me like 20 minutes. Like, what is GBBO? Oh, right, yeah, they're talking about that cooking show. And yesterday it was the same. There was all these messages going through. It's like, what are these people? They're clearly all referring to something that I'm meant to know what they're talking about. And then after about 10 minutes, it's like, oh, clearly Donald Trump is giving a speech. And they're all commenting on this speech. But I can't remember a presidential speech given by an American president or any president or even the UK prime minister that has had such rolling commentary by everybody in my social feed.
I'm very glad I don't use Twitter anymore.
So he's still commanding that sort of appeal. I mean, even Obama's famous Yes We Can, I suppose that happened in the middle of the night, our time. And I suppose it was just before Twitter had really taken off. That's 8 years ago, I guess, now just over.
Yeah.
But yes, whatever nonsense he may put out and however irritating it may be to watch, he is still grabbing everybody's attention. So that's an achievement, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But anyway, you were saying 2017, no dead celebrities, no mad politics.
It's all going to be fine.
It's all going to be fine.
It's all going to be fine.
We're recording this on Thursday afternoon, as usual.
Mm.
They're predicting snow. Very confusingly, this morning, again on the bloody Twitter feed, everyone was saying that all these planes have been cancelled at Heathrow because of the weather. And I sort of looked out the window. Obviously, Heathrow's west, I'm East London. But you sort of look out the window and it's like, what weather? There is no weather. It's like the most nondescript possible weather. And yet they're cancelling flights. But apparently that's because they're expecting snow. I don't know why that means you have to stop planes
taking off. If there isn't any snow, then surely, you know, things can carry on as normal.
It's not even very cold in London at the moment, but apparently snow is on the way. So that's something we'll have.
The threat of snow, that was the headline.
The threat of snow.
You know, snow in winter, what a
in
threat.
In 2017.
Yeah, so, who saw that coming?
So much for global warming,
despite,
as they always say when it snows.
Despite my absolute failure to introduce this podcast and then claim that it was going to be new and snappy, which it now hasn't been. We are here to talk about the last week in the music business.
Yes, no politics.
And that is what we're going to do.
No weather, no evolutionary science. Those are the three things that we do not talk about in this podcast.
I think that is a correct statement. I'll tell you what actually we're going to talk about this week.
Can I just say one more thing before you do that?
Yes, what?
Can we please acknowledge the new table in the studio?
It's not relevant to our listeners.
It's round.
I mean, it's confusing. It's shorter and smaller.
The previous table, I was going to say hexagonal, but I'm not sure it was hexagonal.
No, it was.
Actually, I think it was.
Yes, no, it was.
It was hexagonal, and now we have a round. That's the sort of year 2017 is going to be. It's a round table sort of year. And I'm very excited about it.
Until I arrived, it didn't have a coffee stain.
No,
so, the old one did.
Only one coffee stain on the new round table in the studio. So now that we've acknowledged the new table, I feel that you can begin the podcast proper.
Right. Well, coming up this week, we're going to talk about how Future Publishing just got £9.5 million for free.
Which is good.
Which is nice for Future Publishing. And we're going to have a new occasional section on the podcast where we answer your questions about the music industry and what's going on in it.
Andy felt that we needed a new section in our podcast.
And we're also
the round table wasn't enough. So we have this new section coming up.
And we're also going to talk about Prince. And we're going to talk about Prince now.
Yeah, that was a really weird way of doing that. But there you go. It's 2017. That's what 2017 is all about. Slightly awkward intros to sections.
Lots of things have happened with Prince this week.
It has.
It's
been a busy Prince week.
It's been a Prince deal bonanza and a legal smackdown or something.
Yeah.
Things have happened.
Shall we
explain what things?
In relation.
Let's talk about the deals first.
To Prince. So, obviously, Prince died not a year ago, okay? It was David Bowie who died a year ago. Prince died last April. And what that means is that the people who've been appointed to commercialise Prince's catalogue and legacy by the estate have been busy trying to negotiate some deals over the recent months, and then we've had a number of those deals confirmed this week. Of course, Prince died without a will, which always makes things interesting. And so that's been working its way through the courts ever since last April. As we record this podcast, they are meant to be deciding which bank will get to administrate the estate long term. That's the most exciting development, which American bank will be the administrators, because the organisation that's been doing it, that's called the Bremer Trust, which is a financial organisation. They've been doing all the admin stuff around the Prince estate since he died, but they were always taken on an interim basis. As far as they were concerned, they should have given it up by now. But there is a bit of debate between his... Prince has a number of siblings. Most of them are half-siblings, but he has a number of siblings, and there's a bit of debate amongst them as to who should look after the estate long-term. Having said that, that's just dull admin stuff. In terms of who's going to manage the estate day-to-day to try and sort of protect and develop the Prince legacy and then bring in as much cash as they can from both the brand and the content. They appointed a couple of sort of music industry veterans last year, and whatever happens with the administrator, it seems likely that they are going to continue to be in charge of making the deals and deciding what happens to the Prince catalogue, all that Prince music that was sitting in a vault, concreted, didn't they? Was it they had to drill?
Yeah.
That's right, they didn't have the combination on the door or something, so they had to drill into the vaults. So the two guys who are looking after that, although I hear that one of the siblings wants a third person brought in who used to advise Prince on his charitable giving, on the sort of the money he used to give to charitable organisations. So it might be the two sort of record industry guys who are doing it now are doing all these big money deals. It may be they bring in another person to then give all that give all that money away.
Yeah.
But so two relatively big deals this week. So last year in November, I think, it was confirmed that they were appointing Universal Music Publishing to manage the Prince song catalogue.
Yes.
Universal Music Publishing used to manage the Prince song catalogue back in the day. We know this because of the famous Dancing Baby case involving a Prince track on YouTube, which was Universal Music Publishing who filed the takedown that led to a very long piece of litigation. But so the Prince estate gave all of the songs back to Universal to administrate. But what were the two deals this week, one of which was also with Universal, and one of which was also to do with his songs?
So the first one that happened this week was they did a deal with Universal's merchandise and branding company, Bravado. The statement put out said that that was for strategically curating global programmes that embrace and honour Prince's legacy, embody his invaluable influence on art and culture, and provide exciting new connections for his millions and millions of fans. What that basically means is merch.
T-shirts.
T-shirts and that. Wallets.
And hats.
Hats.
Soap. They could do Prince soap.
Prince soap, yeah.
They could do...
Socks.
No, I don't think Prince socks. I don't think that's going to work.
Gloves?
Gloves, maybe, particularly as it's going to snow. But they'd have to get them made very quickly and into the UK market within the next 24 hours if they were going to do
paper
Prince
plates.
Gloves.
Do you remember when Mucha from the Sugar Babes got the rights to make Sugar Babes paper plates? Great days. Anyway, let's not get into that now.
Let's not get into
that. The other deal that was done this week is potentially a lot more exciting and interesting, because they've chosen GMR, Global Music Rights, owned by Irving Azoff, to be their collecting society. Because obviously in the US, there's more than one collecting society that will pick up your royalties from radio and other public performance stuff. And GMR is a small one, but deals exclusively with kind of bigger name artists.
Yes, well,
set up by Irving Azoff with a view to getting those artists more money.
Yes. So although Universal Music will be administrating the Prince song catalogue, when it comes to things like radio or the performing rights side of streaming and all of that, obviously that usually goes through the collective licensing system. So as you say, in the US, as a songwriter, you get to choose between BMI and ASCAP or CSAC or Global Music Rights. And Global Music Rights is the little boutique, I think is the word they're using, boutique being code for little, the boutique as a performing rights organisation, which was set up to try and negotiate better rates. Because if you're BMI and ASCAP in the US, because you represent such big portions of the overall song catalogue, competition law starts to take an opinion in what you're doing and say, well, that sounds a bit like a monopoly. And so, as we've talked about at great length on the podcast, both BMI and ASCAP are subject to these things called consent decrees that ultimately mean if a licensee, like, say, the radio industry, can't agree with a society, like, say, BMI, as this is something that is actually heading to the rate courts as we speak. Yeah. If those two organisations, two groups of people, can't agree on a rate, then because of the consent decree, it goes to a thing called a rate court, and ultimately the judge decides. This is the rate that American radio will pay. By pulling themselves out of that system, what Global Music Rights is hoping to say, well, we only represent a very small number of songs, so therefore we're no monopoly issues here. But, hey, look at our songwriters. We've got, I mean, they've got Pharrell on the books, haven't they? And now they've got Prince. They've got, I think they've got the John Lennon.
Yeah.
I don't know if that includes Lennon McCartney, if it's just the solo stuff. Anyway, they've got big name songwriters on there. The aim being that they can say, we're not a big performing rights organisation like ASCAP, which is what Prince used to be a member of for most of his career.
Yeah.
We're not like that, so we're not subject to consent decrees. But hey, you try being a radio station without any Prince songs, so therefore we want more money.
Yeah, we want more money because all our artists are worth more.
Yes. Now, this plan may fail.
Yeah, that is currently a matter for the courts to decide.
Because the American radio industry are trying to say, we don't care that you're a tiny little PRO, you're still a monopoly, there should still be some sort of regulation, not a consent decree, but we want these demands. And as it currently stands, Irving is saying, nope, that's nonsense, we're clearly not a monopoly, we represent a really small group of songwriters, screw you, we want more money. And so all of that is going to go through the courts this year. But Prince is yet another sort of Premier League songwriter that now on the Global Music Rights books.
If you want to know more about all that stuff, we discussed that on a podcast late last year. Well, so you can go back and listen to it.
In the archive. Back in the distant past.
The other deal that was discussed, or non-deal, as it may yet turn out to be, discussed this week in the news, was Tidal's exclusive streaming deal on the Prince catalogue and his final two albums. Obviously, they're included in the Prince catalogue, the part of it, but there were, you know, specific things around that. Last year, the Prince estate sued Tidal, saying there is no paperwork to show that there was any agreement whatsoever that Tidal had the exclusive rights to stream the Prince catalogue. In fact, Tidal was exclusively streaming the final two Prince albums, but apparently they've only got the paperwork for the first one of those. So there's no record that they had the exclusive rights to the second one. So yeah, that's all going through the courts. And Tidal responded to that case this week.
Yes.
And I think quite rightly said, dude, Prince was alive when all this happened. So, I mean, yeah, surely that shows that he was into this.
It sort of,
that wasn't the exact wording.
No,
it's basically what they said.
Wouldn't put that in a lawsuit. I mean, I'm highly speculating here, but it sort of seems, obviously, what we do know is while Prince was still alive, he did this deal with Tidal around his penultimate album, as it turned out. And around about that time, most of the Prince music that had been streaming elsewhere was pulled off. As we've discussed before on the podcast, weirdly, a couple of tracks then appeared on Spotify.
Just one track.
One track.
One Spotify-only single.
That we never understood. But at that point, all the stuff came off the streaming services. And while Prince was still alive, Tidal had the exclusive on the two new albums. They were also selling it, weren't they? Certainly a CD and download, was it?
Yeah.
And they still had the most of the Prince sort of catalogue on there as well. And this was all happening while Prince was alive. And it sort of seems like very informal conversations took place between Prince directly, because obviously, although sort of some of the big classic albums from back in the day were released by Warner, Prince released a lot of his own albums. I mean, real early days DIY artist, and then did a deal with Warner that got him control back. So Prince very much represented his own catalogue. And it sort of seems like some very informal conversations took place where Prince went in and said, can you do some stuff with my new album? Hey, yeah, let's do something around my catalogue too. We'll just work with you. We'll pull off all these other streaming services. But then the only thing that got written down was one letter where Prince said, yeah, I'm going to give you the exclusive on my next album. And both Tidal and Roc Nation, Jay-Z's company, apparently have told the court overseeing the Prince estate on several occasions, oh, we have both oral and written agreements about all of this.
Yeah.
But what the estate are saying is we've only seen the written agreement about one bit of this, as you say, just the exclusive stream on the penultimate album. And I suppose you could sort of say, seems a bit weird to do such a big deal with just one letter of intent and the rest sort of on the nod and on the handshake. But it sort of feels like there was an informal deal in place. Then Prince died, and now the estate are saying, well, where's the paperwork? There doesn't seem to be any paperwork, although that may as yet not prove to be the case, but that's certainly what the estate are saying. And so, yes, it's all gone into the courts. We will see what happens. Tidal's argument is more or less what you're saying, which is if Prince had a problem with us streaming his catalogue, he could have said so.
Yeah, because it wasn't like Prince was prone to not notice things.
Or indeed be opinionated on such things. So, remains to be seen if it goes to court. All of this is also interesting because what we also know is with the estate in deal mode, so they've done the publishing, they've done the performing rights, they've done the merch. Apparently they were expecting an announcement on sort of a label partnership moving forward. Prince had started working again with Warner in towards the end of his life. It'll be interesting to see if Warner therefore were the label partner or if they're going to put everything into the Universal camp. And the other thing that we know is ongoing is that the estate are really keen to try and get Prince's catalogue back on certainly Spotify and Apple Music and probably the on-demand services Pandora and iHeart.
What they want to know is if there is an exclusivity agreement in place, how long is that agreement in place for? Because if, you know, if Tidal has documents that says, no, we've got all this music for the next 10 years and no one else can have it, that's a problem because they want it up in time for the Grammys next month.
Yes, and I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? So there's going to be a Prince tribute at the Grammys next month. Of course there is, that's not a surprise. But I suppose what they're anticipating is when that's on TV and presumably they're hoping it'll go viral on YouTube and social networks, suddenly everyone will be like, oh my God, yeah, I want to go and listen to some Prince tracks. And great for Tidal because it would perhaps get them a few more signups. But what the Prince estate want is whichever streaming service those people go to, the music will be there, it can be streamed, they can earn the royalties. So they're keen to get it everywhere. And the estate's position on the Tidal arrangement is not only do you not have an exclusivity deal, you don't have a deal, a non-exclusive deal. So we want to go and do our Spotify and Apple Music arrangements. So it'll be interesting to see if, with these negotiations ongoing with the streaming services, whether they can reach some sort of settlement with Tidal. I don't think anybody really wants all of that to go to court. I don't think Tidal do, because it will probably put the spotlight on their user figures and things like that.
Yeah, no one wants this. Well, Tidal don't want the spotlight on that.
And the estate don't want to be caught up in some messy court wrangling. So I imagine they'll reach some sort of settlement. And yeah, as you say, the Grammy Awards is sort of seen as the deadline for trying to get Prince back up on all of those streaming services. And then moving forward, with all these deals in place, what will happen to all of those unreleased recordings? We know that Prince was always very opinionated about where his music should be. He was quite sensitive about his music being used. So it will be interesting to see if, I would imagine it would be the siblings who might try and force caution on just sticking everything out there. But it could well be that we see a lot more Prince music. And of course, the
Prince... Of course, I mean, as other posthumously successful artists who had a big archive of stuff to put out, it makes sense to put that stuff out slowly rather than all at once.
Yes, go the two-pack route and still be releasing.
Well, because if you release one new album every 1 to 3 years, then that's another thing for people to get excited about, where if it all comes out at once, it's done then.
Although given indications about the size of the vault of unreleased prints, that could be 100 years worth of music.
Well, if that's the case, so be it.
Still to come, but there you go. Hey, they need to get it out by a certain point in order to make sure they don't lose the copyright in Europe. But more on that later.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is all the Prince news. Is that all the Prince
news?
That
is all the Prince news.
A lot of Prince news.
There's a lot of it, yeah. But I'm sure that's not the last of it. I'm sure we'll come back to Prince on podcasts of the future. We'll have to travel to the future and see. I think that's wrapped up this section.
Well done. That's very, very good wrap up there.
Still to come, going to answer your questions, or a question from one of you, and look at some of this week's other stories in brief. But now let's talk about Team Rock, which went into administration, I think, actually after we'd recorded the last podcast. So we haven't discussed this before, because Team Rock, which owned Metal Hammer and Classic Rock and the other surrounding brands and award ceremonies, etc., went into administration just before Christmas, putting 73 staff out of a job without severance, which is always a nice way to start the festive period.
Well, I suppose that was the thing, wasn't it? I mean, it was one of those things where, with hindsight, perhaps it didn't come out of the blue, but it did feel like it came out of the blue. And it's always sad when music companies or music media companies go out of business. It's sad when much-loved brands...
Well, especially as Team Rock started with quite bold ambitions and looked like it might make a go of it.
And it's always sad, obviously, when people lose their jobs, particularly if they don't see it coming, but... So that's all just sort of heightened by many levels when it happens like 3 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
And everybody is sort of, they're just about to go on Christmas break. Obviously, everybody incurs expenses around Christmas time that are more than the rest of the year. And you're out of work and you're not going to get any severance money. And so, yeah, it was a little bit of a shock before Christmas. And so you say Team Rock's a relatively young company. It was launched informally in 2012, but sort of came on our radar in 2013. It was set up by a couple of ex-radio people who had worked for The Guardian's radio company. Doesn't exist anymore, but GMG Radio as was. And one of the radio stations that operated under that banner was Rock Radio. And so some of the people who have been involved in that radio station set up this company called Team Rock. It had ambitions to be a digital and online radio station, but also very quickly they acquired Metal Hammer and Classic Rock and all the spin-off titles and awards from Future Publishing. And so that was interesting because they were radio people, but they bought these sort of print brands, and then they had lots of bold ambitions to be the multimedia rock company that would have print, they would have online, they would have radio, they would have online radio and all of this sort of stuff. And they hired a lot of people. I mean, actually, 73 people for a company that, okay, they had, if you counted all the different spin-offs, maybe about 5 different magazines, and they have the Hub website and the radio station. But I mean, even so, that's a lot of people, actually, for a relatively small media operation. But as you said, they had big ambitions. They launched the sort of the Hub Team Rock website. They had the radio station. Although I suppose, you know, in the last couple of years, the radio station, they took it off digital, off the DAB network and made it online only. At that point, they talked a lot about how they were going to do more global radio programming online, although that never really seemed to happen. Also, last year, they did things like they announced a partnership with a ticketing company. So clearly that was in a bid to try and bring in a new revenue stream. So perhaps with hindsight, it wasn't as big a shock as it seemed on the day it was announced. But it was certainly upsetting for the people who worked there. And I mean, Metal Hammer and Classic Rock, but I mean, Metal Hammer in particular, the metal community is a very loyal community.
Yeah.
And metal fans are very loyal to their bands, but also metal fans are very loyal to the sort of the festivals and the media that cover that music. I think, I suppose, if you are a big metal fan and that's the music you really, really like, when you turn on the radio, there's not a lot there for you. When you turn on TV, there's not a lot there for you. So when you have a magazine like Metal Hammer that has been championing that genre for a very long time now, and then it sort of spins off and it has a video bit and a radio bit, you like that and you welcome that. And so I think metal fans were very loyal to this magazine and therefore upset to see, A, it looked like for a time, was this it? Is it the end of Metal Hammer? Plus all these journalists I like are suddenly out of work.
Yeah, and in fact, to that end, after the redundancies were announced and, you know, these people were going to be going, you know, suddenly with no pay over Christmas, the band Orange Goblin launched a crowdfunding campaign, I think initially to raise like £20,000, which, you know, not a great deal of money to go around all these 73 people who've now got no work indefinitely. But actually, they raised way over their original target. I mean, that campaign's still going on.
I mean, last time I looked, it was over 80 grand. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, a lot of money. And I mean, one would imagine not all the 73 people will need the money because some of the people will have been on a bigger salary and yeah, they won't be. Even if it is just 1,500 quid to the average person, I mean, these people will get other jobs. Also, when a company goes bankrupt, ultimately, if wages are unpaid, the government eventually steps in and somewhere down the line, forms get filled out and bureaucracy happens and you will get a little bit of money off the government. But that is, I suppose, you know, there was some chatter online, you know, is this the right use of a fundraising campaign? Will it really help? But I suppose if you are suddenly out of work and you've got rent to pay and you know, you need 6 weeks to go and find new work, then actually that is the sort of sum of money that can really help with that. So, and it was nice to see people and a lot of like metal labels and promoters and other artists all chucking in a little bit of money to help make that happen. Plus they did a fundraising gig, didn't
they?
Yes,
they did.
At the start of the month, which will have raised a little bit more money as
yes. well. Yes. But the news this week, which we're getting to now, is that the magazines have been saved. They've been bought by Future Publishing, which is, as
the
we
company who
discussed,
sold
the company that sold them 4 years ago, well, in 2013 anyway, for £10.2 million. They've now brought them back for £800,000. So that's the free £9.5 million I referenced earlier on.
So Future is a publicly listed magazine company, so their finances are pretty transparent on the stock exchange. And I mean, like all magazine companies, they have been struggling of late, but I mean, that's a pretty good return.
Yeah.
It sells up over 10 million and then buy it back for less than a million. We don't quite know the 800 grand that they future paid to reclaim Metal Hammer and Classic Rock and the spin-offs. They get the awards and the Prog magazine and Blues magazine. Obviously, we don't know if they're taking on any of the liabilities, although certainly the wording of the announcement, it didn't say they were buying the company. It said they were buying the company's assets, yeah, their magazines, the awards, the online stuff, which sort of suggests that they're not taking on the liabilities. So that it is, you know, 800 grand without lots of costs incoming. In terms of how many of those 73 people will be taken on, it's good news for the brands, it's good news for fans of the magazine. I don't think it's going to be good news for a lot of those people who lost their jobs.
No, presumably they're going to continue those titles with a smaller staff than they've had.
Yes, and I mean, obviously, Future already have sales teams and marketing teams and all of the back
office
stuff.
And presumably some of the people who were made redundant worked on the radio side of things, which I suspect is not going to be continuing.
No, it said that they were buying the assets for that, but I can't believe it's going to be a top priority for Future. I mean, in their statement, Future, I mean, it was a statement very much aimed at the city.
Yeah.
So the boss of Future talks a lot about sort of integrated multimedia, Future, blah, 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 that sort of stuff.
Yeah, Future CEO Zilla Bing Thorne said that it marks a further step in their buy and build strategy. I mean, it's a step on from their sell and tear down strategy of 3 years ago. But yeah, and now they are building a specialist media platform in which they monetize through diversifying revenue streams.
So,
which are basically, I mean, well, so Team Rock really kind of a magazine and radio company. Future is really building itself into a magazine and events company. A lot of their magazines are kind of, you've got like Total Guitarist Rhythm. Like,
yeah, magazines.
They're focused at people who play instruments.
Rather than buying music.
And then they have the London Drum Show, which is, you know, a trade show for drummers. The London Bass Guitar Show, which they bought last year. If that's where they were moving into, you can kind of see why they got rid of the more kind of fan-focused titles. But I think they could still build all that into a business that works together.
That's interesting, though. So I was thinking, with all this talk about diversifying revenue, blah, 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 perhaps radio was still going to be part of that mix. But it's interesting, you're thinking it's more of the sort of the trade fair event stuff around these brands. I mean, any magazine publisher will tell you it's a really tricky time to be trying to make money out of music journalism and music media, because traditionally you made money by selling your magazine and putting advertising in your magazine. You still make money selling the magazine. You still make money out of advertising in your magazine. But every magazine, pretty much, certainly those that you pay for, they're selling a lot less now than they used to. Every month that goes by, you sell less copies. So those revenue streams are in decline and probably in terminal decline. They will eventually go. So what do you do online? And what all magazine publishers find online, they're probably talking to more people now than they ever did in their history. The challenge is making money out of that audience. You know, generally, with consumer-facing titles, people won't pay to access your website. The money to be made from online advertising is rubbish, because people spend all their online advertising with Facebook and Google, not with publishers. So what do you do? Do you sell merch? Do you sell tickets? Do you do events? Do you do sponsorship? Do you allow brands to actually get involved in creating the content? Those are all things that different magazine publishers are experimenting with. But it is a very tricky time to make money out of music media. And clearly, Team Rock had bold ambitions, couldn't get there fast enough, couldn't raise any more money to help them go through a few more years. So will Future be able to make it work with seemingly a slightly different strategy? So almost a happy ending in that these brands are not going, and Metal Hammer, as I say, in particular, a much-loved brand, although I imagine there are still a lot of people on both certainly the commercial side and probably also the editorial side of Team Rock who are still going to be looking for new jobs as the new year starts.
Yeah, but we'll see what the future holds.
Will we? Is that what you're going with?
That's my wrap-up for that section.
To wrap up this section.
Yeah.
It's good. Good. Thanks.
Before we head into our final section, let's just have a quick look through some of the other things that have happened this week that we're not going to talk about in any great detail. First off, I think we've got a story that's going to run and run. It's just part of a story that's already run and run. But basically, the Carpenters are suing Universal over unpaid royalties.
The living Carpenter.
Yes. And the estate of Karen Carpenter.
Yes. So this is two things. It's a classic royalties dispute. So the Carpenters have sent their auditors into Universal Music, specifically the A&M label, And they say that the auditors found all sorts of problems with the way that Universal have been calculating the money that the Carpenters are due. However, the second bit is part of that is the old sell versus license element, which basically is how do you classify a download? Do you classify it like a CD sale or do you classify it like a sync deal, licensing deal? That's important from an artist because it has a big impact on how much of the money they see. They see a lot more from a license than a sale. This has been a debate ever since iTunes first kicked off, whenever that was. Continues to be a debate.
There have been a lot of cases surrounding this, most of which have settled.
There were some big class action cases where lots of artists all signed up to the litigation. In the main, all of those have settled out of court. Really, the labels almost winning in that they agreed that artists should be getting slightly more on download income than they do on CD income. But I mean, really slightly more, like 2% more.
Not the 50-50 that artists would be pushing for.
Exactly. A classic major label deal from the 1990s would have paid 15% on a sale, but 50% on a license. So it's a big difference. And in the main, the class actions, when they were settled, that was not what the labels were offering. They were offering like 18% or something. So most of those lawsuits have sort of run their course. The big landmark case where the artist really won was the FBT Productions case. So the Bass Brothers, who worked on some of the early Eminem recordings, they also sued Universal. That was the big landmark judgment.
And that's what was referenced in this Carpenters case.
Indeed, because obviously that was with a Universal label. There have been other cases along the way. The big one that's ongoing is the one between 19 Entertainment, who represent some of the American Idol finalists, and Sony Music. So that's a case that is still slowly working its way through the courts. But I suppose the thing is, these days, whenever an artist, like a heritage artist, has a general royalties squabble with record companies, and that's not new. I mean, heritage artists have always had royalties squabbles with their labels. And these days, whenever one of those royalties squabbles goes legal, there will always be a section allocated to this. How do we define a download and a stream? And how do we take jargon from an old record contract and apply it to digital income? But it will be interesting to see if this case gets to court and whether we get any real judicial consideration on the old sales versus license point. As far as I can see, this is focusing mainly on iTunes revenue. The reason why the 19 case is more interesting is I think there's an even stronger case for saying it's clearly a license on a stream than it is a download, and that hasn't been tested in court in the same way as it has been with iTunes income.
The universities of Edinburgh, Glasgow and Newcastle have announced a new UK live music census where they're going to try to get a picture of the health and value of the UK live music. And this is basically in the news this week because they've asked for volunteers to come forward to help out. It's basically one day in March, they're going to get all these volunteers to go to a gig and kind of report back various bits of data from that gig about kind of, you know, the genre and who was in the audience, things like that. They want people to come and join in with that.
If you go to the podcast notes, you'll get a link to the story that we reported on.
If you go to uklivemusiccensus.org, you'll just get straight to it.
All right, then.
But you can go to...
I was trying to be helpful.
Yeah, well, you know where that ends. Mariah Carey, she's been embroiled in a story that, in hindsight, should probably not have gone into the brief section because it's really not a brief story.
But this was, she was on the big New Year's Eve show on American telly.
Yeah.
It all went horribly wrong.
New Year's Rockin' Eve, institution that it is.
There were technical issues, which meant that she couldn't really perform. So she walked off stage. And then afterwards, it was her manager who basically then started saying they were screwing over my client. They did it because having Mariah not singing was a bigger news story than having Mariah singing. And so then you have backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
We did this,
So basically
this.
What happened is, like, it went wrong.
And it was live TV.
Yeah, it was live TV. It went wrong and she ended up walking off stage early. And then they got on with the end of the show. It was before midnight. She was kind of the big act before. They have the ball drop at midnight, which I still don't know what that is, even though I report on it every year and have never bothered to find out what it is.
What ball drops?
Well, I don't need to know what the ball drop is. It's a thing. It's in Times Square. It happens. Then it's midnight when that happens. Anyway, so that all went wrong and that's not good for anyone. But, you know, if everyone ignored it, it would have gone away very quickly. But instead, Mariah and her manager spent a week giving interviews about it and putting out statements and going, oh, they were just trying to make this a big story. It's like, the only reports I've seen on this are you talking about. And now here we are talking about it again. Let's not talk about it.
Let's not talk about that.
Let's talk about Donald Trump's inauguration party.
Upcoming.
And who isn't going to be playing it.
So a really weird, eclectic mix of artists have now gone on the record saying they were invited to play Donald Trump's inauguration party. artists that you just can't believe Team Trump slash the Republicans would be inviting. So what we assume has gone on is that Donald Trump, knowing that sort of the really obvious big American artists don't want to be associated with him, have gone to some booking agencies and said, is there anyone who will play? They've then emailed their entire roster of artists, which is how you end up with people like Moby saying, I've been asked to play the Donald Trump inauguration. And various people said they didn't want to. Yes. So you've identified Charlotte Church.
Charlotte Church as well. I mean, this has been an ongoing story since last year because they really have been struggling to get anyone. And there was a point last year where they were spinning it as like, Donald doesn't think he needs musicians to play his big party. It's not important to him. But clearly it is, because artists are still being asked. And so we've had Rebecca Ferguson, former X Factor runner-up. We've had Moby, we've had Charlotte Church, all who've come forward and said, oh, yeah. Well, actually, no, Moby and Rebecca Ferguson said, oh, I'd do it in exchange for demand that you're never going to agree to. And Charlotte Church just said, no. No chance.
Well, she was sort of saying, you have seen all the interviews where I've been slagging you off.
But it's just, say they've gone to William Morris and said, have you got any artists? And William Morris has just gone, well, I don't know. Just email everyone and ask. And then, of course, the ones who are the most anti-Trump are going to come out and go, why have I been asked this? And then tweet about it.
Last I heard, various army bands were going to play because they have to. Because if the commander-in-chief says, play me some music, they don't have any choice about the matter.
It's unfortunate, isn't it?
So if you like marching bands, it could be a good show.
And quickly, just at the end of the section, I think it's worth returning to
the best story.
The best
of 2016.
Story of 2016.
Hey, 2017, you've got to match this.
Ed Sheeran got allegedly stabbed in the face by a princess.
That's last year.
Although you've added
the allegedly, which
well, I've added the allegedly now because Ed Sheeran, obviously, when this story happened, Ed Sheeran was still on his self-imposed extraction from public life. Whereas now he's back, he's promoting, he's got two new singles out, he's promoting stuff. And so now he's getting asked about this story that came out in November. And while he admits that he was stabbed in the face with a ceremonial sword, which the scar on his face makes it hard to pretend that didn't happen, he's refusing to say who did it, which I can only assume is he doesn't want to get a royal in trouble. But why not, I say.
But he was saying that James Blunt wanted it to be known that he had done it.
It was James.
He liked the story.
James Blunt wanted him to spin it as he'd done it as an attempt to kill Ed Sheeran and claim back his pop crown, which I'm not sure James Blunt was ever as big as Ed Sheeran. So that doesn't work at all.
Ed Sheeran new album. It's the division symbol this time, isn't it? You know how he's sort of working his way around the calculator. I was hoping for the right bracket. But he's sticking with Plan A, which is...
If he has a really long career, do you think he's going to move on to the scientific calculator?
I hope so. Sort of pi or the infinity symbol or exclamation... Surely someone's released an album with the exclamation mark before.
Oh, yeah, you'd think.
But that means something in maths, doesn't it? The exclamation
mark. I don't get maths.
So, let's hope he has a very long career and we can follow him around the calculator. So Ed Sheeran's back. That's 2017.
That's the news, really.
Yeah.
If you want to read more about any of those stories, why not just, go to the notes for this podcast and get the links? That's what I'd do. Hey, everyone.
That was very loud.
Sorry, I got excited. I got excited because it's a new section on the podcast. We're going to do a new thing.
This is CMU Q&A.
Not an official title. We haven't actually got around to calling it.
I've already made a logo.
Have you?
That's what we'll have to call it.
Okay. Why has this section got a logo?
CMU Q&A.
Q&A.
Yeah, that looks good, doesn't it? Can you imagine that?
I'm imagining it.
Written in white, trebuchet and a blue background. You know, we always we always go to above and beyond when we're designing CMU logos.
Yeah,
it's going to be quite the thing.
Anyway, we thought it would be fun.
Andy thought it would be fun.
I thought it would be fun. No, we thought it would be fun. We thought it would be great.
I didn't actually think at all, but go on.
We just thought we'd throw it open to the listeners a bit and find out what they want to know about the music industry, because otherwise it's just us talking about whatever we think is good, and we're idiots.
From this point onwards, if you have a question about the music industry, which can either be, as it is this week, related to one of the stories we've reported on where you don't really understand what we're talking about, although that is basically you saying that you read a story in the CMU Daily and you didn't understand.
I don't understand half of them.
What we were banging on about. So it could be something to do with something that's actually in the news, or it could just be a generic music business, music industry sort of question.
Something that bugs you about the music industry that you've never bothered asking anyone about.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah?
Okay. This week in CMU Approved, you said that one of the approved track sounds like a lesson in pop history as heard in a dream.
Yeah.
What the fuck does that mean?
That means what it says.
Right.
Right. It sounds like general classic pop sounding things, but it sounds like if you had a dream about classic pop, it would be weird, and that's what it sounds like.
Right. Interesting. Still don't really understand what you're going on about, but that's my question answered.
Have a dream about classic pop.
I will tonight. Yes. Okay, that's what I'll do.
Put that in your diary.
I'll do that tonight, and I'll report back next week to see whether I now understand what you were talking about.
I have an actual question.
Okay.
John asks, can you tell me about that Motown thing in a way I can easily understand?
So this is the question, which is, I read something in the CMU Daily and I didn't understand
it. Yeah. Well, it is slightly complicated. I mean, I'm assuming that it's the Motown thing that we wrote about this week. It could be any Motown thing.
It could be.
But let's talk about the thing we wrote about this week.
Let's talk about the thing we wrote about this week rather than just Motown records in general. There was a musical that failed, wasn't there? Was there a Motown musical? That might be libel. I think they're not doing a musical around the Motown story, and it didn't do very well.
There must have been one, yeah.
Oh, I may have made that up. Whereas this I didn't make up.
But this is a quite slightly complicated copyright story. Shall I explain it to the best of my knowledge and then you tell me if I'm wrong?
Yes. It is one of my favourite copyright technicalities, and it's
a good one.
What's also good about this is, and I mean, it's good for this section of the podcast, because basically this comes up every single year at the start of January.
Yeah, it's good timing.
First time it happened, which I imagine would have been 2014, I did some research. I spoke to the intellectual property office.
You did? You spent quite a long time on it.
In the United Kingdom.
And ever since, you just rehashed the same story.
And I got them to confirm stuff, and now I basically rehash the same story every year. Thanks to this question, I get to rehash it here on the podcast, and we'll be able to cut this out and rerun it. If we don't mention Motown from this point onwards, we just mention that record, then we'll be able to rerun this in the first podcast of 2018.
Okay, so here's my understanding of this story. At the end of the year, I think it was the 30th of December, Motown suddenly released a new album, or Universal suddenly released a new album called Motown Unreleased 1966 or something like that. And that's sort of a weird album to put out at the end of the year.
Full of previously unreleased tracks from 1966 recorded by Motown artists like Marvin Gaye.
Yes.
Who wouldn't want that?
No one wants that. No one wants that. So I guess the question is why? Why has this appeared? And in fact, why last year did a Beach Boys album appear? Why previous to that did a Beatles album appear? All very much in this theme.
And at the moment, pretty much every year, Sony, I think, are putting out a Bob Dylan unreleased rarities album from each of the year in the 60s.
And so the reason for this is that in 2011, the copyright period in Europe was extended from 50 to 70 years.
For sound recordings. For songs, it's life plus 70 years, but we're just talking about sound recordings.
Talking about sound recordings. And that only applies to sound recordings that have been released. So anything that was recorded in 1966 but not released would lose its copyright period, or would come out of copyright at the end of 2016, or the beginning, if it's the 1st of January 2017. And so that's why stuff's being released.
More or less.
To sort of reboot, to give it a new 70-year copyright over its previous 50-year copyright. So 120 years copyright. Great stuff. Although they didn't do anything for 50 years.
Exactly, and couldn't have done for this to apply. So
I'm not sure that was
a good A to the queue.
Yeah.
So the sound recording copyright term, as you say, is now 70 years after release. So whereas with songs, the copyright term is the life of the creators and then another 70 years. But with sound recordings, it's not linked to anybody's life. It is just 70 years after release. However, actually, if you look at copyright law, what it actually says is that the sound recording copyright term is linked to a certain number of years after recording or release. Okay, so the term is either a number of years after the recording or a number of years after release. Well, just basic common sense tells you that the release will always come after. You can't release it before the recording, can you?
No, you can't.
So traditionally how it used to work, before the copyright extension, when it was a 50-year copyright term, which is what it was prior to, well, as you say, the law changed in 2011. Actually, it came into effect in 2013. So prior to 2013, in Europe, the copyright term for a sound recording was 50 years after recording or release. And what that meant was, the minute you made a recording, the 50 years started ticking, But then when you released the recording, then it basically rebooted and it went back to 50 years and it started ticking again. So if you released it almost immediately, then it was just the same 50 years. But if you sat on it for 5 years and then you released it, then the years have been ticking. But at the year five, you release it and it reboots and you get back and you now have 50 years after release. But what it meant was if you didn't release it within the 50 years, then the copyright would expire even though you'd never released it. And if you released it in year 51, 52, 53, it didn't matter. It was still out of copyright and therefore public domain. When the copyright extension happened, it only extended the after release bit, not the after recording bit.
Right.
Okay, so if you look at the 2011 European directive, which did this, you also have to look at the 2006 directive because it was amending the 2000, so it doesn't make sense on its own. And what it says is change 50 to 70 in sentences 2 and 3 of this article of the 2006 directive. Sentence one was the bit that said 50 years after recording. So the extension only applies to release. So what this means is if you've got a track that was recorded in 1966 that was also released in 1966, then we're 50 years in, we've got another 20 years of the copyright to go because we've now got a 70-year sound recording right. However, if it hasn't been released, then the 50 years, you've still only got a 50-year window and the 50 years is about to expire. But by releasing it on the 30th of December, they could have done it on the 31st, but that wouldn't have been a New Music Friday. By releasing it on the 30th of December, you've done it within the 50-year window. And then, of course, the rule is 70 years after release. So actually, you've now got another 70 years worth of copyright. And so what you're finding is, since all of this came in 2013, every year, because of copyright terms, actually, it doesn't expire exactly on 70 years or 50 years or whatever. It always is the 1st of January, the year after the 50, 70, whatever years is up. So loads of stuff will always come public domain on the 1st of January. And ever since this extension has taken place, at the end of every year, you will see, and obviously we're slowly working our way through the 1960s catalogue. And as we get to the late 60s, that's when a lot of the really valuable stuff will start to appear. So you're getting all of this releasing of these unreleased rarities to ensure that they get the copyright protection in Europe. This is only affecting the European Union. Other countries have different rules on copyright terms.
But these are unreleased rarities that they never thought in the last 50 years were worth releasing.
Well, they never got round to releasing. And I suppose you can look at it both sides. On one level, it's a sneaky trick that keeps these recordings that would otherwise become public domain, which means we could all have them for free, and they reboot the copyright, and now they've got it for 70 years, and they can continue to charge us to access that content for 70 years. Although the flip side is, if it wasn't for this little technicality in copyright law, chances are those recordings would have remained locked in a filing cabinet somewhere, and we would never have heard them, because there would never have been an incentive to do this. I suppose they might have been at the end of the, you know, whatever the old copyright term would be. But it is sort of persuading labels to go digging, find this content, and stick it out there. So at least,
although they're not really doing it in any meaningful way, they're just sticking it out there because it would go public domain if they didn't.
Yes, but that means it's sitting there online and people can access it and listen to it. And I think
other people can do stuff with playlists and make it interesting.
Yeah. And I suppose once it's out there, there is an incentive to then start pushing it and trying to get people listening to it. I suppose it's interesting because most of these sort of copyright reboot releases to date have been an artist. So even if they sneak it onto iTunes at the last minute, you know, Dylan fans, Beatles fans, Beach Boys fans, they're going to go and find that music and they'll probably get quite excited about it. A sort of mishmash of random Motown stuff, some of which are artists we've heard of, some of which are artists we've long since forgotten, isn't perhaps quite so exciting. Although actually, I mean, it's interesting they've done that. I can sort of foresee that actually that might now become the norm. On the last day of every year, we'll have the Sony 1967 album and the Universal 1967, the Warner, and there won't even be a specific as saying, well, it was the Motown label. They'll just be pushing out these rarities to reboot the copyright to get that 70 years of protection.
I guess, yeah, as you get more into the pop era and when more and more stuff was being recorded, you're going to get 500 track compilation.
Yes.
Every December.
Every the 31st of December to reboot the copyright. So that's why, and as I say, this will happen every year, and it means every year there will be another round of these stories. People will be saying, well, hang on a second, what was that about? Why suddenly are these rarities getting released in a really sort of weird, under the radar sort of way? And that is the answer, and we'll be able to reuse this in a year's time if somebody else asks the same question when they release the 1967. What rarities could there have been in 1967 that we've never heard?
I still haven't heard the 1966 ones, and I doubt that I will, but you never know.
You never know.
But yeah, I hope that was an adequate answer to that question. If you have a question about anything at all, although, I mean, really, preferably just keep it music industry related, but, you know, you never know.
Evolutionary science.
We might go into evolutionary
Andy's
science.
Andy's going to read up on that this week, just in case.
Yeah. You can email us on the CMU podcast at unlimitedmedia.co.uk. And we'll see if we can help you out.
If you are coming to any of the events where I'm talking at, so I'm doing a CMU Insights training session for IMRO in Dublin next week. I'm doing a lecture on digital dollar stuff at BIM later in the month. So if you come to any of those events and there is a question, then feel free to write it down and give it to me that, and then I can answer it here on the podcast rather than just necessarily doing it in the room.
Writing things down.
On a post-it note.
Old school operation.
Yeah. That's another option. Otherwise, CMU podcast at unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
Yes. And then that is it for our first podcast of 2017. Here's the thing. I was listening to this week's episode of Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces podcast on my way to the studio today. It's an interview with Matt Willis from Busted. It's a very good interview. Even if you're not into Busted, I would recommend listening to it because he really goes into a lot of detail about kind of the issues that come with being in a band that blows up very quickly and seems to come out of nowhere when it's necessarily not the case that they've just appeared out of the blue, and how that affects you, how you don't necessarily appreciate the good things that are happening to you because you're always... I mean, one of his examples was... They played 12 nights at the Wembley Arena, and rather than thinking, that's really good, we've just done that, that's amazing, they were thinking, when are we going to play Wembley Stadium? And then he talks about addiction and his problems with that, during and post-Busted, and then kind of bringing the band back together and taking the decision to basically form a new band with the same name and the same members 10 years after the fact, basically, you know, write songs that don't fit with the previous incarnation of Busted. It's really good.
I will go and listen to that. I'm probably the only person in the world who still has his copy of the Matt Willis solo album on CD.
He discusses that.
I like that album.
Very briefly.
I was the only person in the world who did, but I liked it.
That is an example of recommending a podcast. You can recommend this podcast to people in a similar way, if you like. I would. I mean, I do. But people think that I'm just pushing my own stuff. So if you did it, and I mean you, the listener, not Chris, because it's the same problem.
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that both Scroobius Pip and Matt Willis will now be recommending.
Well, I assume so,
I mean,
that's
how it works, isn't it?
That is how it works, yeah.
So I look forward to them recommending our podcast to people.
Yes. If you want to recommend us by name, my name is Andy Malt, and his is Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty, who should also be recommended to everyone. And if you want more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Blah, 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 that sort of stuff.
What did you say?
I think I just said blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I mean, in the...